Good morning, lads. How are you, Jerry and Owen?
You start the day with a good energy.
Good morning, Jerry and Owen. How are we doing, lads?
Yeah, good.
Off the Ball Breakfast.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
There's no f***ing filler.
Off the Ball Rugby.
Have you been in Crumbark before? 2009.
Leicester are lucky to be blessed to be given us. We're going to play there next year, hopefully, with the
Leicester. But GA is shite.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
All right, it's 17 minutes past nine. A new feature-length film out is going to premiere at the Lighthouse in Dublin tonight. It's called The Anatomy of a Massacre, and it tells the story of the 1974 Dublin and Monaghan bombings. It's a film by Fergus Dowd and director Joe Lee, who's with us now, along with Margaret Irwin, who heads up the Justice for the Forgotten group that works on behalf of families affected by bombings and shootings, primarily, and that's from The Troubles, and Bernie McNally, who was caught up in the bombing. Folks, you're very welcome to the studio. Thanks a million for coming in. Thank you very much. Have you had a private screening of this? Bernie, I'll go to you first on that.
We have, yes.
So yeah, you've seen it.
It's very moving.
Yeah.
It's very informative, and I think it'll be a great view for, you know, bringing the reality of the day to the viewers.
How is it hard for you to revisit it? It's been a thing in your life for the last 50 years.
Yeah, not at this stage. I have to say, listening to other survivors and family members, listening to their story is very moving, you know. There's a lot of them are very hard to listen to.
Yeah.
You know. I suppose for me, I survived and I was just so lucky to survive. And I had a family to go home to, my parents and my family and that. But there was a lot of people who lost their husbands and wives and children, you know. So it was very hard for them. And then just to be totally abandoned by the government was just awful for the families and what they and the survivors had to go through alone.
Awful.
Well, awful, yeah. Absolutely awful.
You were working in Talbot Street on the day, is that right?
I was working in O'Neill's shoe shop in Talbot Street.
Yeah.
And it was just coming up to 5:30 and I went down to the storeroom to get a pair of sandals for a customer. And I heard the first bomb explode in Parnell Street. When you're 16, you kind of don't realise the damage a bomb can do, I suppose. And so I ran in and got the shoes and came back up the stairs because I was rushing in a hurry to get out of the shop and go home. And I met Mae McKenna. She lived up over the shop, and herself and Mr. O'Neill were standing in the hallway between the two shops because there was the gents on one side and the ladies on this side. And she said to me, did I hear a bomb explode? And I said, yeah, I think it was a bomb. But as I stepped into the lady's shop, there was a big flash in the sky. And I thought it was lightning, so I thought, oh, it's probably thunder and lightning. But that was, you didn't get time to think anything else. It was just the blast hit you then. So that was it then. I got some serious injuries and that, and I was in hospital for 6 weeks.
And devastation everywhere. I've listened to and read some of the accounts over the last 24 hours.
Oh, my God, yeah. The devastation in the street. Well, it was, I suppose you're in shock, and it's very hard to, you're kind of transported from reality to this, like, demolition site. I can't explain it. It's just chaotic in seconds. And just absolutely terrible. Looking at the scene around Talbot Street was, like, it wasn't that there was loads of people running and screaming in the vicinity where I was. It was just silence. And there was things scattered, but you didn't realise it was bodies that were scattered. And then I saw a fireman take a body out of a guy in his window. But at the time I thought they were taking the mannequins out in case they got broken. So then I was taken to Moran's Hotel. And then I was there for a while. I was treated by some doctor who bandaged up my head and that. And then I was taken to somebody came in and said, anybody that can walk, there was a bus outside to take us to the hospital because there was no emergency services for Talbot Street at that stage. And a man called Kevin Rowe went into Bus Aris. He worked there and he took a bus out and he filled that with all the injured and took us all to Patrick Jones Hospital. So
What age were you, Bernie?
16.
The scene that you describe and the aftermath, the silence, is something that is, that jumps out, the disbelief. Was there a moment at some point afterwards where you, where the reality of what had happened began to sink in?
I suppose because I was in hospital for 6 weeks. Okay, so I was kind of taken away from it, from what was going on outside. I didn't see newspapers. I wasn't aware really of the amount of people that were killed or that. But I remember just the night before I came out of hospital, and I said to my dad, God, I'm a little bit nervous going out, Dad, because you've been in so long in the hospital for 6 weeks, and I didn't know what to expect when I went out. And he said, well, don't worry, love, this will be all history by Christmas. Well, he didn't literally mean it the way it was. It was buried by the government after that, and the guards, and, you know, so... The reality of it, I suppose, how huge it was didn't hit me until 1999 when I joined Justice for the Forgotten. In 1998, I had to have my eye removed because of the injuries. And in 1999, I joined in with Justice for the Forgotten. And that brought the reality home to me of how huge this was and the amount of people killed and the amount of people injured. And the cover up and the abandonment of families and that. So that's where the struggle goes on in the aftermath.
Which is where Margaret comes in.
That's it, yeah.
How did you get involved, Margaret?
I got involved by accident, really, back after the broadcasting of Hidden Hand, The Forgotten Massacre, which was a documentary broadcast by Yorkshire Television in July 93. And I think that just brought it home to me what had happened because, as Bernie has said, it was buried, you know. And in the film, I know they referred to it as the silent years, where there was absolutely nothing between the time of the bombing and the very early 90s because there were no questions raised in Dáil Éireann. The media just ignored it. There was just absolutely nothing.
Why was that?
Well, it's very hard to be absolutely certain as to why it happened, but I think the government and the opposition of the day just wanted to have it buried. And they, obviously, the whole political background to it was that the Ulster workers' strike had begun in the north to try to bring down the first attempt at a power-sharing executive. It was the very first time that nationalists were involved in governing the North since partition. And obviously the loyalists didn't like it, the majority of unionists didn't like it, and certainly elements of the British state didn't like it either. And so this all-out strike started on the 15th of May, and 3 days later, the bombs exploded. They were planted by the UVF. Three no-warning bombs in Dublin at rush hour, and an hour and a half later, a fourth no-warning bomb in Monaghan. And so the strike brought down the power-sharing executive. It collapsed on the 28th of May, and the Irish government certainly kept their heads down after that. But there was, I think, an attempt to airbrush this because they didn't want to give any comfort to the IRA in case, I think, young people might join. But they also, you know, they just kept their heads below the parapet after that. Mm. And it was a long time before anything was ever done. I mean, the Garda investigation itself was wound down within 3 months of the bombings, which
missing
is incredible. Well, there was just nothing. They actually did their final reports. Monaghan was closed by July, and Dublin was closed by, I think, about the 9th or 10th of August. That's the greatest mass murder in the history of the state.
Another devastation, isn't it, for the families? I was watching a report from I think it might have been 1995 at the time, where the some of the families had gone in to talk to Nora Owen, who's the Minister for Justice at that time, and she had said basically what you've summarised there, Margaret.
I was at that meeting, actually, and she said, if you find any evidence, bring it to me, you know, if
That's
you should find any.
Yeah. That's
but, you know, the families then were campaigning for a public inquiry. The Yorkshire TV was the catalyst for our campaign. And without that, who knows whether anything would have happened. We don't know, it's, you know, at the moment. But that was the catalyst. And we tried to get people together then after that. I got involved because a mutual friend of a couple of families and myself asked me would I help them in my spare time just to type letters to send to the Taoiseach of the day and the ministers and so on. But every door was closed against the families. And it was only in 1999, after the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, and Bertie Ahern was Taoiseach, and he met families, a serving Taoiseach met the families for the first time just before the 25th anniversary in 1999. And from then on, we were in dialogue with the government, with the Taoiseach, in terms of trying to get something to remedy the situation. And eventually, in January 2000, we got the Barron Report. Liam Hamilton was initially the person investigating, the judge investigating. But sadly, he had to resign because he was terminally ill. And then Judge Henry Barron took over.
34 victims who aged from 5 months to 80 years of age, I believe. There was a lot of young women involved, and it was an indiscriminate slaughter of human life. And the 50 years that have passed, Margaret, you're obviously in constant communication with the families, and this sort of, you know, as you've described there.
Yes, for 30 years, yeah.
Yeah, for 30 years, yeah. And that trying to bring the perpetrators to justice seems to have been an incredible struggle. You mentioned the media's role in it. We'll maybe bring a good opportunity to bring you, Joe, into proceedings. How did you get involved in the making of this? Why this movie?
We linked up with Margaret through, I think it was Maureen O'Sullivan who linked us together. And we sort of began a conversation about trying to do a film. And from the very beginning, the idea was to try and highlight the stories of the families, stories like the story that Bernie has told. Because we were really aware that a lot of younger people wouldn't know very much about it at all. I have a very vague memory of the day I was playing football up in Coolock, and we actually, out in Coolock, we heard the bomb. So, you know, our job, we felt, was to try and primarily tell the story of the families and the victims, but then to tell the story of justice for the forgotten, who have been the people who have been representing those families all that time.
Yeah, I think it is fair enough to say that a lot of people have an awareness of the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. They don't have an awareness of a lot of the detail that we've been discussing here, and we can go into a bit more detail on in relation to the alleged cover-up around it.
Well, that was our sort of our job, in a way, was to try and bring all these things together into some coherent kind of narrative that would inform people about the story that, you know, a lot of people, as I say, wouldn't know. Like, Margaret had done some research in trying to find out how many people in the political sphere had actually asked questions about it, and she might be able to just sort of tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's just looking back at to see, I think I mentioned it about no questions raised in the Dáil. And in fact, there was a question asked on the first around the first anniversary in 75. Had anyone been caught for this atrocity? And the answer was, "Oh, we can't discuss Garda investigations." And then from then, 17 years passed without one question being raised in the Dáil.
And who asked that question?
I think it was Tony Gregory who. He certainly was very active. Mm-hmm. And then another person who began asking questions also was Trevor Sargent. And then Caoimhín Ó Caoláin. He was the very first Sinn Féin TD for many years in Dáil Éireann. So they were the people who began to ask the questions back in the 90s. Back in the 90s. But there had been a complete silence before that. And there was a trade unionist called Kevin Walsh from Ballyfermot who had been going into a meeting in Liberty Hall on the day, and he heard the first bomb explode, and he immediately went to help, and he almost walked into the bombing in Talbot Street. So he witnessed the carnage on the day, and he was expecting all the time that there would be commemorations and that a memorial would be erected, but nothing happened. So when 10 years came, he began lobbying successive Lord Mayors and trying to get something done, get a monument erected. And it was only when Sean Haughey became Lord Mayor of Dublin that he had any success. And Sean Haughey did listen to him, and a small monument was erected outside the Garden of Remembrance initially. And he also got a mass said in the pro-cathedral, and he put ads in the evening papers asking families to come. So Kevin was a marvellous man, and sadly he's no longer with us. We'd love to have him for the 50th anniversary, but he's dead several years now. But he was the only one who had done anything. Mm. And then, of course, very soon after, you had the Yorkshire Television programme. And it took it on from there.
And where are we at now? I know there was the Boucher report in the UK. There was some details on that a little while ago. There's a lot of chat about the UVF, obviously, their role in this. Don't worry about that. That's fine. Where our audience are used to interruptions. They're okay with that. The UVF and their role in it and the Lenang gang. What's the position now with that report, maybe on both sides of the water?
Well, that report is continuing. That review is actually the technical term for it. It's continuing, and we're expecting a report to be published before the year end. John Boucher was leading it, and he's now, of course, the chief constable of the PSNI, and he's been replaced by Sir Ian Livingston. He's a former chief constable of Scotland, so he's now leading it. So we're hopeful, you know, it's kind of the last chance, really, to get to the truth, and that's what the families want, you know. That's what the focus always has been, on trying to get to the truth. But we also have an investigation by the police ombudsman for Northern Ireland, Marie Anderson, and that's expected to report in the coming months. Mm. And her remit is limited to looking at the misfeasance by the RUC at the time, but the Denton is wider because it can look at the UDR, the Ulster Defence Regiment, and the British Army as well. So we're very hopeful that between the two reports, we will get some answers for the families after all, after 50 years, half a century.
There's still a lot of anger, isn't there? Like, even in Monaghan's my hometown, and there's still a lot of anger 50 years on, I'd imagine. Certainly the lack of documents releasing, I think, is the main thing from the British government. That seems to be the crux of it, is it, I guess, Bernie? But these documents were never released, even for the Barron report.
Yeah. That's right. But I think people are so frustrated. Maybe there are angry people out there, but the frustration gets overbearing at times because of all the doors closing on you, and because they're always finding an excuse not to bring you the full way, you know, to the truth. Mm-hmm. And after 50 years, I think it's the least that they can give people is the truth as to what happened that day. Mm. You know, I don't know how you deal with it then, but we need to know the truth. Mm.
Maybe partly the unsaid stuff, Margaret, that you're talking about in relation to the alleged collusion of police officers in the north in relation to this. It's a theme that we've seen, obviously, in relation to other atrocities over the years as well. I presume that's the unsaid backdrop here when you say, you know, for 17 years no questions were asked in the Dáil, where, you know, missing files, reviews rather than investigations is the backdrop to all of this thing, and the ultimate shame that it will bring, I suppose, for significant institutions across the water.
Yes, well, that's if the full truth comes out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the review, just to clarify, the review, it was termed that by the judge in the High Court in Belfast, that was what should happen. I mean, this came about because one of the family members, Eddie Bernard, took a case. His brother was killed in a bomb which was planted by members of the Glenan gang on St. Patrick's Day in 1976 in Dungannon. And so he took the case, and that is how the Dent Operation Denton came about. But what was ordered was a review. So then the Gardaí decided they couldn't cooperate with it because they could only cooperate with an investigation. I mean, it just seems like such a technicality. But it took them 14 or 15 months then to bring in the necessary legislation to allow the Gardaí to make documents and files available to the Denton team. But anyway, that happened, and we understand that the Gardaí are fully cooperating with Operation Denton at the moment.
Mm. It's very frustrating, I'm sure, on all sides that it hasn't, after 50 years, reached a stage where the question isn't asked, what do you need? Let us provide whatever it is, resources we can throw at it, call it whatever it needs to be called to open the doors to get access to that.
Margaret points to a really important thing there. You know, that obviously, you know, without the British authorities releasing the files that are there about it, the truth can never really be fully known. But it is really important to remember that on the Irish side, when people in the around 1999, 2000, asked to look, like the Taoiseach of the country asked to look at the Garda files, and he has said to us in the documentary that there was nothing there. There was nothing there to look at. So, you know, how did that happen? And the answer to that has never been given, you know. So it is the British side, but the Irish side are culpable as well.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, Joe, about the the story of Derek Byrne, who features in the movie as well? Because that's a fascinating...
Yeah,
a talented footballer as well, Bill.
The documentaries I do often sort of cover social history sort of things. And when we interviewed Derek, and Derek sadly passed away in the last year, but Derek told us that he played for Belvedere and that he'd been involved in the inner city seven-a-sides, that tournaments that took place in the summertime. And Derek, in fact, we couldn't include it in the film because it would have kind of created another narrative sort of storyline that we couldn't follow through on. But he was going for trials to Tottenham Hotspurs and Nottingham Forest. He'd been chosen. It was about six or seven people who were chosen to go over. And he'd actually bought a pair of football boots with his first wage packet, because that was his first kind of full-time job when he was serving petrol in Parnell Street. So he you know, the injuries he sustained that day stayed with him for the rest of his life. Mm. And he had over 30 operations in Jervis Street as a result. In actual fact, he was pronounced dead when he arrived at Jervis Street and was in the morgue in the hospital for 6 or 7 hours, and he woke up in the morgue. But the life that he had after was just so totally different from the life that he'd expected, you know, where he may well have become a professional footballer. Yeah. I think one of the people that he from that group did actually become a professional player.
Mm. We have a short clip of Derek, as you said, he passed away, I think, in November.
Yes, Margaret would know, and Bernie would know Derek, and he was involved with Justice for the Forgotten from the very beginning. Margaret, you would remember Derek.
Yes, he was
Derek.
The very first survivor to get involved. And so I knew Derek for 30 years. And, of course, we haven't mentioned that we have a civil case as well. We're taking the British government to court in Belfast. And the Crown Solicitor has tried to thwart us every step of the way. And they took a challenge, which was heard last November, the 13th and 14th in Belfast, where they tried to stop us getting into the High Court because for jurisdictional reasons and time limits and so on. Mm. And we were just amazed to see Derek get on the train. It was the worst day weather-wise of the year. There was a storm, which meant the train had to go slowly because of leaves on the line. and it was absolutely lashing with rain, and people were advised not to go out that morning. And there was Derek in a wheelchair on the train with his faithful wife Liz pushing the wheelchair, and his son and daughter were there as well. And it was great that he was determined to be in court that day. And his barrister Cormac O'Doulachan, who's a long time friend of ours and has worked so many years, was representing him and actually mentioned him to the master of the court, which the case was heard before. But we had to wait until April. Sadly, Derek passed away 5 days later on the 18th of November, very suddenly. And so he didn't survive to hear the result of that challenge. And in fact, the challenge was rejected by the master. So we will now be able to take the case into the High Court in Belfast. We've no date for that as yet, but hopefully it will happen before too long.
Derek did an interview with us, you know, while he still was quite ill. And but just as a memento to his kind of footballing past, we included a photograph in the Gloucester Diamond in the inner city of I think it was the final one of the matches there. But it's just a little small reminder and pointer towards how important those seven-a-side tournaments were for inner city communities. I came across a number of them in other places like O'Devney Gardens and places like that.
Yeah. And remain so to this day. We do have a short clip of Derek that you mentioned from the piece. We can take that now.
And I remember saving a man in a cream-coloured Volkswagen Beetle.
Next minute there was a big explosion. I just seen flames, heard screaming.
I thought I'd done it. I did. I thought it. I let the pump run. Because I went in, I paid for the petrol, coming back out to change. I'd taken the nozzle out, and when it happened, I was blown back. I had the pump in my right hand, and it went right through my left. And then I was playing myself for years.
He said at the end of that clip that he was blaming himself for years. He thought that he might have had some part in it, that he was working with petrol at that time. It's a very tough story. It's a very tough position that you guys have been in over the last 50 years, Bernie. It's testament to your persistence that you're sat here this morning so well able to tell your story and eloquently as well. And I'm sure and hopeful that the movie that the guys are making will bring a bit more spotlight to it.
Please God, yeah, because I think the greatest shame would be for us not to get the truth. And the greatest shame on the country, you know, and on the British government and all those who have fought us and thwarted us along the way. I think that'll be the greatest shame of all, but to get no truth.
Feels like it's about time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well and beyond the time.
Movies, that's the hope, I presume, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, Maureen O'Sullivan pointed out to us that there's no mention of this in the history curriculum in schools. Mm-hmm. And we really feel that, and we really feel that making the film and the attention around the 50th anniversary should really draw attention to that, because it's really important that just like Bloody Sunday and the Stardust and that, this is a very important thing that shouldn't be overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your hope, Margaret, finally, that the review...
Well, hopefully that it will bring answers to the families, and that we can get to the... They can get the truth at last, because they've been waiting long enough.
Yeah. It's a good note to leave it on. Thanks a million for coming in,
Thank
folks.
You very
Thanks
much.
A lot. Joe, Thank best you. Of luck this evening with the screening at the Lighthouse. It's at the Lighthouse Cinema. And
next week it's on in the IFI on Thursday evening. And it's up in Monaghan in the Garage Theatre on the 24th of this month. And I think on the 17th they're doing a screening of it in Derry as well.
Okay. Very important story to be told. It's called The Anatomy of a Massacre. It relates to the...
Can I just correct you slightly on that? The full title is May 1774 and the byline is Anatomy of a Massacre.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll look at it. And is there somewhere that people should go to check it out online?
Yeah, and only the websites to do it that, whether that's the Lighthouse, the IFI or the Garage Theatre in Monaghan.
They'll have all the details. All right.
They'll have all the details.
Thanks for coming in, Margaret Irwin and Bernie McNally. Thanks a lot for coming in. Just sit tight for 1 second.
Off the ball, rugby.
Have you been in Cromarty before?
2009. Leicester are lucky to be blessed to be given us. We're going to play there next year, hopefully, with the
Leicester. But GA is shy.
GA is shy.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.